From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're keeping an eye on Hurricane Sally, which is already dumping a lot of rain on the Gulf Coast. It's expected to make landfall tomorrow near the Alabama-Mississippi border. We're also watching the fires in the West. President Trump is back at the White House today for a ceremony to mark diplomatic deals in the Middle East, but he was in California yesterday and dismissed concerns about global warming contributing to the fires. He had this exchange with Wade Crowfoot, Secretary of California's Natural Resources Agency.
It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, California's Governor Gavin Newsom was also sitting with President Trump when he made those comments yesterday, and Newsom also talked about climate change and its role in the fires. What has been the reaction to those comments from President Trump and his dismissal right in front of people who are dealing with the consequences of climate change?
And we should say that the fires are made worse, that the conditions are made worse by climate change. But there are other matters like land management. And part of what Governor Newsom was telling President Trump is President Trump says it's all about forest management. Gavin Newsom was saying, by the way, a majority of the forests in California are actually federal lands. But in terms of the climate change issue, The president of the United States saying, well, you know, science doesn't know, that is inevitably going to end up in the part of the Democratic message machine, sort of lumped in more largely with the president's approach to coronavirus as well. The idea that he doesn't believe in science is something that's been used against him, and this is certainly more fodder for that.
Well, and in fact, we've already heard from the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden on this. Here's what he said yesterday.
If you give a climate arsonist four more years in the White House, why would anyone be surprised if we have more America ablaze?
How important do you think that this issue, climate change, is going to be in the campaign as we get closer to the election? And I'm specifically thinking about maybe people on the left who might not have been as enthused about Biden as they would have been about, say, Bernie Sanders, but maybe they look at a situation like this and say, well, on the issue of climate change, which I care about a lot, there is a major difference.
Yeah, and maybe Biden was psychic because he delivered those remarks before President Trump said what he said in California. But of course, President Trump has said things like this before. In terms of how it will matter for the campaign, I think that you're right that the one place that it could potentially help is with younger voters on the left for whom climate change is absolutely an animating issue that defines their lives in a way. But in terms of the broader electorate, I'm looking at a Kaiser Family Foundation poll that tracked what voters say is the most important issue to them in making their decision about voting. In February of this year, 14% of people said climate change. In September of this year, climate change did not even make the cut. It is below the 4% of people who say that immigration is their top issue. And the economy is the top issue, which, of course, is the one area where President Trump continues to poll slightly stronger than Joe Biden.
Tam, President Trump is presiding over a ceremony today with Israel's prime minister and officials from the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain signing diplomatic agreements. Can President Trump claim this is some sort of Middle East peace deal?
He is claiming it, and he is claiming it that there are other countries, at least five other countries, he says, who want in on this. This is not the Middle East peace deal that everyone is talking about. It is a couple of deals to normalize relations. But what the White House is hoping is, one, that they can convince people that this is a big deal. And it is a deal, but also that this can force the Palestinians to the table, or that if they can get enough Arab nations to normalize relations with Israel, that they could move toward some semblance of a broader peace in the region.
That is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who, by the way, is going to be at a town hall where the president will be tonight in Philadelphia with some uncommitted voters. So we will wait to hear how that goes. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Voters in Ohio will have to pay for their own postage stamps if they want to vote by mail after a state board last night denied a request for prepaid postage from Ohio's Republican Secretary of State. It's the latest bout in a battle over mail-in voting in the swing state that's also the site of several lawsuits over voting rights. Frank LaRose is Ohio's Secretary of State, and he joins us now. And first, what's your reaction to the decision to deny prepaid postage for mail-in ballots?
You know, Tanya, my real concern is about getting the ballots back as soon as we can. Sure, it's an inconvenience. It's important, though, to emphasize that Ohio has three good choices. Really, you can vote absentee in Ohio. There's 4 weeks of doing that. Anybody that wants to can vote absentee. We're encouraging that by sending every registered voter in the state a absentee ballot request form along with a self-addressed envelope for sending that back. And the good news is we've seen recently, over a million Ohioans have already requested that absentee ballot, which is by far a record in that. So that's good news. But we also have 4 weeks of early voting where, again, anybody that wants to can go vote early. And then, of course, the polls will be open from 6:30 a.m. until 7:30 p.m. on Election Day. So as much as I'm disappointed, and this, by the way, is a request that I began making back in May. But one other choice that you have in Ohio is that if you don't want to mail it in, every county board of elections has a secure 24/7 drop box that's available. This is the first general election ever in our state's history that that's the case. So, again, two good choices for how you return your absentee ballot. It's unfortunate we didn't get postage paid envelopes, so.
Okay, I want to break down the process in Ohio a bit more. Thank you for giving us all of those details. You mentioned that more than a million requests for absentee ballots have already been received. Do you think the state is prepared to handle this volume of absentee voting?
Generally, our boards of elections are built around the assumption that they're going to get between 20 and 25% of their ballots in by mail. I've told our boards of elections way back in March to prepare for that number to potentially double. That's why we pushed the CARES Act money that we received in Ohio almost immediately out the door, of course, to buy personal protective equipment and hire extra staff, but also to buy additional mail handling equipment. Something as simple as that $1,000 machine that slices open envelopes could be a big process improvement for a small rural county that traditionally had cut all those envelopes open by hand, for example. And then, of course, as I mentioned, adding extra staff is key as well.
Well, Frank, I want to ask you about that extra staff. So the state's 88-county Board of Elections reported they had hired nearly 34,000 poll workers so far. But that's less than the 37,000 needed for Election Day. How short are you on poll workers now, and what are you doing to close that gap?
We really need, as you said, 37,000 just to open the polls on Election Day. That's the bare minimum. At the most recent count, they were up to 44,000. I want them to get to 55,000. I'm confident that they'll get there. A lot of good things going on, and we're asking Ohioans to step up and answer this call to duty by going to voteohio.gov and signing up.
One of the challenges, though, is COVID-19. Have you considered what will happen if some of those poll workers get COVID-19 before the election? I mean, statistically, it's possible. What are you telling local election officials they should do if they find out someone on their staff is infected? Is there a process in place for this?
There absolutely is. In fact, we put out to our county boards of elections over a month and a half ago a set of guidelines that were developed in conjunction with the CDC and our Ohio Department of Health, of course, that they not come to work if they've had a known exposure. Also happy to report that we've seen a number of Ohio companies that have stepped up to donate personal protective equipment. Voting locations and those early voting locations will be safe and healthy.
You're being sued by the League of Women Voters of Ohio, the NAACP of Ohio, and other groups over a rule that allows each county to have just one drop box for absentee ballots. You actually blocked Cuyahoga County's plan to provide drop-off sites at libraries. Those who filed suit say you're making it harder for people to vote. Why limit the number of places people can drop off their ballots?
Well, certainly not going to get too deep into pending litigation, except for to say I've long been a fan of expanding the Dropbox program in Ohio. I've made that very clear. The question is, do I have the legal authority to do it? Title 35, which is our state law that lays out how elections work, makes it very clear how ballots must be returned to the director of the Board of Elections. And to be clear, what I did yesterday with Cuyahoga County is I asked them to hit the pause button because with two pending pieces of litigation on this, we need to be very careful about moving forward and making sure that we're not creating more uncertainty for Ohio's voters. And so that may be a perfectly reasonable plan, but we just have to push the pause button on that for now.
I want to ask you about something else. The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee have actually intervened in those lawsuits in your defense. National GOP groups are involved in voting litigation in several states, but usually in reaction to lawsuits by Democratic groups. In Ohio, they're fighting nonpartisan plaintiffs. Do you worry that people will see the Trump campaign's involvement and accuse you of making access to the ballot a partisan issue?
Well, anybody that accuses me of that simply doesn't know me. This is something that I take very seriously. My oath of office to serve as Ohio Secretary of State means that I serve all people. Although I was elected as a Republican in this role, I wear the referee's jersey. What I do is so much bigger than party. I mean, think about this. What we do as elections officials is protect the very foundation of our way of life. That's way bigger than party, and that's something that I take very seriously. And anybody that would say that the actions that my office takes are partisan, just simply not paying attention.
That's Frank LaRose. He is Ohio Secretary of State. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
More than 194,000 people have now died from COVID-19 in the U.S. That's according to data from Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. has seen the highest number of deaths and the most cases of any country in the world. But where are the hotspots now, and why are they seeing so many cases? Joining us now is Dr. Tom Inglesby, Director of the Center for Health Security of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Doctor, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. Good to be here.
Well, and early on in the pandemic, back in the spring, New York City was clearly the center of the pandemic in the United States. Then in the summer, we saw a surge of cases in places like Florida, Georgia, Texas, Arizona. What about now? What do you see happening right now in terms of the outbreaks from COVID-19?
So you're right. Yes. So we saw different phases over the course of the pandemic. And at this point, we're seeing the Midwest as having the greatest number of states with rises in cases. So they haven't reached anywhere near the peaks that we saw early on in places like New York City, for example. But in terms of overall rise in numbers of cases per day, we're seeing trouble in the Dakotas and Iowa, Oklahoma, Nebraska. So states across the Midwest are really undergoing the difficult times now.
What do you think is the reason for that? Because along the way, we heard, you know, meatpacking plants that would lead to an outbreak somewhere, or prisons and stuff like that. Is there any commonality in terms of where the surges are happening?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, even now, we still don't have great data that tells us the answer to those questions. But we do know that there has been a transition from concentrations in major cities over time, moving from metropolitan areas to what's called now micropolitan areas, where disease is really happening in smaller towns and smaller communities. Not to say we don't still have problems in big cities, but it's now moving more, it's more spread in the country. And there probably are many reasons for this, but some of them do include facilities where there's really either people in congregate living settings, nursing homes or in prisons, but also places like meatpacking factories.
You haven't mentioned politics, but I want to ask you about that, because President Trump held that rally in Nevada over the weekend with very little social distancing. Last week, he was in North Carolina and he touted the crowd there that had gathered for him and claimed that Joe Biden wouldn't have such a crowd. Listen.
If he had 200 people, I think it would be a lot. I really mean. You ever see the gyms with the circles? That's his crowd.
He's talking about the gyms with the circles because Biden's events have these circles to maintain social distancing. I was looking, Dr. Inglesby, at the top 19 states with the highest number of new cases per 100,000 people in the last week. All of them are red states that Trump won in 2016. So is that a coincidence, or do you think that politics and people's views of this virus based on politics are playing a role in where the outbreaks are happening now?
Well, I do think that state leadership and local leadership matters a whole lot. And we've seen in the summertime that there were many states that opened very quickly and had trouble following that. There are still 18 states in the country that don't have masking mandates in place. And that's really unfortunate, since we know that masks do diminish the spread of disease and they do it in a way that doesn't affect the economy. So to me, that doesn't make any sense. And for political leaders at whatever level, federal level, state level, local level, to be encouraging people to gather indoors and to mock social distancing when we know it works, that's the kind of thing that's going to extend and prolong and worsen this outbreak in the country. So those kinds of actions, I think, are really irresponsible, especially since we know now what the right actions should be.
Let's not just talk about bad news. There are places in this country that have seen great improvements in terms of number of new cases and deaths from COVID-19. What are you looking at in terms of a bright spot, and what are they doing right in those places?
Yeah, there are many places in the country which have had a really substantial decline in their overall numbers, the percent positive tests that are coming back. And some of those places, many of those places are in the Northeast, but there are places in the Mountain West which have very low prevalence. And there are pockets of good news in many parts of the country. In places, many places now, there are mask mandates or there are local ordinances, which I think have helped a lot. We're also seeing improvements, some improvements in patient outcomes, who are people who are hospitalized. The clinical community has learned a lot since this started in terms of how to take care of very sick people. We've got the new medicine, the dexamethasone and other glucocorticoids, which we know improves mortality. So there are definitely bright spots, but despite that, we still have, you know, something in the order of 750 deaths a day in this country. And that, compared to most of the world, is still really, really unfortunate. And I think we can do so much better.
Part of the justification for some of the stay-at-home orders back in the spring was that we needed to reduce the caseload so that hospitals wouldn't be overwhelmed. Is that still a concern now, or are hospitals now prepared enough that if there was a surge like what we saw back in March, that they'd be able to handle it?
I think the answer to that depends on the city. There's much more planning has been able to be done since March, when hospitals were really kind of trying to get into gear really quickly. And we have many more ventilators, and the loads in hospitals are far lower than they were at their peaks. And so that's all good news. I think the problem now is that in places that are out of big cities, the smaller towns, rural communities, where the level of intensive care that a community can provide is much lower, they may have very few beds. If those places have large rises or surges in cases this fall, it is possible that there could be big mismatches in smaller towns where people can't get the care they need, and at a minimum would have to be moved to other places where they could get care. We hope that doesn't happen, but depending on how things unfold in the fall and whether there is a larger fall wave, that is a risk.
Are you expecting a large fall wave?
I honestly don't know at this point. I think that we've just talked about some of the good trends, which will kind of, you know, like mitigate against that. But on the other hand, we know that indoor settings are far, far riskier than outdoor settings. As the country gets colder and people move inside, if we start bringing large groups of people together inside, that is how the disease is spread. And the other big driver for the fall is, you know, kind of the reopenings of schools and universities. Mm-hmm. We're now seeing some university towns experiencing pretty big outbreaks, and whether they can be contained quickly or whether they grow into, you know, their own new surges, I think that's it's too soon to say. We're hopeful that, you know, we can, with more testing and with good social distancing and masking, that we can kind of try and blunt the impact of the regathering in universities and schools. But I don't think we know that yet.
That is Tom Inglesby, the director of the Center for Health Security of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Inglesby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, globally, just under 930,000 people have died from COVID-19, according to estimates from Johns Hopkins. So let's look at what's happening worldwide with Nurit Eisenman, NPR Global Health and Development correspondent. Nurit, after the U.S., Brazil has the most COVID deaths, 132,000. The president there has downplayed the pandemic. What is happening now in Brazil?
Well, as chaotic as the government's response has been, people did increase their social distancing in Brazil somewhat. And starting about 3 weeks ago, the number of daily new deaths finally did start to drop quite substantially. That said, just as in the U.S., disease experts warn that Brazil may be following this pattern of once things improve, people ease up on the social distancing too fast. And for instance, over the last week, the daily death count actually seems to have hit more of a plateau. And when it comes to new deaths per day, Brazil still ranks among the highest in the world right now. I mean, it's only behind the U.S. and India.
And India has lost more than 80,000 people to COVID. It's in third in the death toll. That country put in place a strict lockdown in the spring. That was eased in May. There's been an acceleration in cases since then. What's happening there?
Yeah. Unfortunately, that early shutdown devastated India's economy, and the government has since shifted to a strategy of opening up a lot of regular life apart from schools. The result, right now, the virus is killing more people per day in India than in any other country. And as you said, third in the death toll overall. And what's worse, this daily new death toll is on the upswing. It's been rising steeply for weeks. Also, the outbreak seems to be shifting from urban areas to rural ones where there's less healthcare infrastructure.
China is where this all started. They seem to have had success in containing the virus. Have they? Do we believe those numbers that there aren't really any new cases coming out of China?
Well, I mean, officially, transmission has been near zero across China for months now. And Wuhan is one of several cities in China where we've been seeing images of events that would be unimaginable in so many other parts of the world right now. I mean, massive pool parties, concerts, not to mention kids going back to school. Though when it comes to schools, for instance, they do appear to still have a very strict system for reviewing everyone's travel histories, test result status. So there is concern.
We've talked a lot on this show about what's happening in Europe, so I'm going to skip that because we have limited time here. But what's happening in Israel? There's a new shutdown coming later this week.
Yeah, this is a real shift from the reopening there in the spring. Now, schools, restaurants, malls, and hotels will all close again. Because by early this month, you know, Israel was topping 4,000 new virus cases a day. It's one of the highest number per million in the world. So they're just retrenching all over again.
It's interesting that they are doing that in Israel. And the prime minister of Israel is in Washington, D.C. today, meeting with President Trump. Nurit Eisenman, NPR Global Health and Development Correspondent, thank you.
Glad to do it.
Apple is set to debut new watches and iPads at its annual launch event today, but no new iPhones. But much of the tech world is still trying to make sense of the deal announced this week between Oracle and TikTok, which is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. Let's bring in Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios, who's in San Francisco. Ina, Oracle is not going to buy TikTok as originally planned, but instead become its trusted tech partner. What does that mean exactly?
I think we really don't know. I think what they're trying to do is instead of selling TikTok, they're trying to put in a layer where a U.S. tech company really can see how TikTok works and kind of verify that the data isn't leaving the U.S.
President Trump had threatened to ban TikTok if it was not sold to an American company, and he signed an executive order prohibiting American companies from doing business with TikTok as long as it is owned by ByteDance. Obviously, this new arrangement falls short of that. So would this deal, do we know, be acceptable to the White House?
Well, it's President Trump, so nobody knows. I mean, I think the betting that's going on here is by choosing a tech company with whom he has very close relations. Oracle has probably the closest relationship with Trump of any tech company, that they would be okay with something that really isn't what they asked for at all.
And by the way, remind our listeners what Oracle does when it's not becoming the trusted tech partner of TikTok.
Yeah, they are not known for their hip social media, but rather they're one of the biggest players in software that businesses use. So Oracle for a long time was the number two software player to Microsoft, and that's how they build themselves. But corporate databases, sales software, sort of everything that businesses use to do their own big corporate software. So nothing at all like TikTok.
The Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told CNBC that this proposal includes TikTok creating 20,000 new jobs in the U.S. What do we know about that?
Well, TikTok had already said, look, we're going to create a lot of jobs in the U.S. if we're allowed to do business. And so they're sort of reiterating that and adding a long-term component. But here's the thing, and this is what is so challenging for reporters and so frustrating for people that focus on the space. Here we're conflating economic growth with ostensible security concerns. Which is it? Is the U.S. looking for job creation engines, or is it really have legitimate security concerns? And if so, the way to address security concerns is not about creating jobs.
Well, and it sounds from what you're saying like we don't really have any details about how this supposed national security threat from TikTok would be dealt with in this deal.
We really don't. And again, this conflation of security concerns with economics has persisted throughout the Trump administration's trade battle with China. And we see this with Huawei and ZTE, where you see the economic issues really coming to the forefront when what's been raised is a national security concern. And really, those two things should be separate in a real thoughtful debate around the issue.
Is China going to be cool with this agreement?
It's hard to say. I mean, it certainly doesn't make them sell it. So it's really about optics at this point and if either side is willing to be seen as budging. So I think as long as both sides can save face and keep the status quo, they might be all right with it. But it remains to be seen. You know, China is every bit as big a player in this trade battle as President Trump, and both sides have kind of dug their heels in. So it's going to be really interesting, but I suspect we'll see TikTok remain.
That is Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Ina, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This presidential election, all eyes are on battleground states like North Carolina and places like Robeson County, just south of Fayetteville. The county is home to the Lumbee tribe, the largest non-federally recognized tribe east of the Mississippi. It's one of the most diverse rural areas, and after consistently voting Democrat in 2016, the county went red in favor of now President Donald Trump. It's why Lumbee Tribal Chair Harvey Godwin Jr. calls it a swing tribe and an important factor in this election. Chairman Godwin joins us now, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tanya. It's good to be with you today.
And Chairman Godwin, as I noted, the county went for President Trump in 2016, but this year you say that many in the Lumbee tribe are undecided and could actually swing the county. You've said being a swing tribe is actually good for Indian country. What do you mean by that?
The Lumbee tribe, good or bad, enjoys the same challenges as other tribes across the nation, like access to broadband, health care, education, violence against women, affordable housing, economic development. So we're all facing the same issues, but also paying attention to the Lumbee tribe as we get national exposure because of our ability to swing either way. It brings a greater focus on the issues for all Indian country, and especially other state-recognized tribes across the nation and here, right here in North Carolina, who don't get much focus. But it brings, I think, focus to us all, and which is a positive thing. And I'm hoping that it will inspire other tribes to become more involved in the political process. And the bottom line is, our native voices matter most when we are active in the nation's form of government.
And Harvey, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that, participating in the political process. But I also want to talk to you about those issues that are important. So this year, the election is being seen really as a referendum on how well President Trump has handled the pandemic. What is the sentiment from tribal members on this issue in particular, on how the pandemic has been handled?
Well, the way the tribe would look at that, and we do have tribal members who are supporters of President Trump. Let's be clear about that. So, but what the tribe has done itself, from HUD and through NAHASDA, we were able to get $4.5 million in CARES Act funding. And what the tribe did itself was we've administered 4,500 test ourselves. We set up testing sites across our rural areas. As a tribe, we came together as a tribal government, and we were able to do these things for our people. And I think that's unique about the Lumbee people, is that we had to create our own way of helping our people.
You mentioned the significant number of tribal members who are supporters of President Trump or are leaning towards voting for President Trump. What is appealing about his platform and message?
Well, as you probably know, we're in a Bible Belt, and we have people that are devout Christians, and they believe in some of the things. And I wouldn't say particularly about President Trump, but just conservatism about owning guns, of not the government not telling them what to do, and just conservative values that are out there, not necessarily because of President Trump.
Based on what you know, how is Biden viewed? I mean, he's more moderate than some of the more progressive wings of the Democratic Party. Does that appeal at all to Lumbee members?
When I'm talking about conservatism and how our people may vote, on the other side of it, I'm not hearing much because there hasn't been, like, President Trump's been to North Carolina 3 times in the last, week and a half or something like that, coming more times. And I don't think Vice President Biden has made on the ground here yet. But when he does, we'll get more feel for it. But right now, I can't really say.
So as we know, Harvey, this election year is also defined by the summer of protests against police brutality and for Black lives. And the Lumbee tribe is known for being a diverse mix of people who have both Black and Indigenous backgrounds. But how is the community responding to the increased call for racial justice?
Our people have, we live in a tri-racial community now. I mean, it's African-American, Caucasian, American Indian, and now Latino. So we lived through the Jim Crow segregated years as well, when there were just Indian schools, Black schools, white schools. So we've lived through all that. Our people have come through that time. And we welcome others into our community. But in addition to periods of struggle and racial unrest, my people have worked with our African-American neighbors and friends to remove unjust barriers in our communities. Even in 1958, Lumbee people went to the Battle of Hayes Palm, which is nearby Maxon, North Carolina, where we drove out the Ku Klux Klan. We've always worked together for the greater good of each other, not just African-American and American Indian, but other groups as well.
You're very passionate about getting people active in the political process, getting folks to vote. To have influence in November, the Lumbee people need to turn out. Mail-in voting has been historically low. What efforts is the Lumbee taking to get people registered and able to vote in 2020?
I guess one of my biggest concerns is the valid fears associated with COVID will impact especially the elders of our tribes. And I'm hopeful that our tribal members will take advantage of the alternate ways to make their voices heard by using early voting options, which have been established by our local and state voting officials. And I really encourage them to do so.
That's Lumbee Tribal Chairman Harvey Godwin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Three of the country's largest U.S. cities now have the worst air quality in the world. Authorities in Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and the San Francisco Bay Area are asking people to stay indoors and close all windows as firefighters fight dozens of fires burning. But for thousands of homeless people, finding a place with good air quality is next to impossible. Adama Izobinim is a volunteer with Mask Oakland, an organization that distributes masks to unsheltered people in the San Francisco Bay Area, a place where the homeless population has doubled in size over the past few years. And Adama, you were out there giving out masks. How are people faring?
So we actually luckily were able to get a large in-kind donation for KN95 masks, and we've been doing a lot of street distribution over the last week. But I think in part there's sort of a mask fatigue, if that makes sense. Mm. So folks have been dealing with COVID for nearly half a year at this point, and now compounded with this fire season, it's just been a lot.
You mentioned you've been able to receive masks that are donated. You all started in 2017 when the fires in Napa caused the air quality to drop. But it's really mm-hmm. the first time we saw widespread use of N95 masks back then.
Now, with COVID-19, as you mentioned, and the PPE shortages, how are you all still getting masks in large quantities?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so when COVID hit largely in the U.S. back in March, we had a stockpile of N95 masks left over. And so we pivoted to distributing to physicians. So a lot of different Kaiser hospitals and even the Women and Infant Care Native American Health Center. But since then, we've been able to connect with a local distributor who's been able to give us a lot of masks at a great rate, and we've been able to get a lot of in-kind donations just in the last few weeks. So those have been largely KN95 masks that we've been able to give out.
You know, moving forward, I'm just thinking about all the things that we have to consider and really be prepared for. How is Mask Oakland preparing for what looks like a really long fire season? And what do you want people to consider?
I think the large overarching points to consider are just that climate change is real. And I want folks to realize that this has long-term impacts, just respiratory impacts on the lungs. And so when folks are outside for prolonged periods of time and they're unable to shelter in place, this is something that does impact folks long-term. As COVID goes on and the economic impacts fall out from that, there will likely be a surge of more unhoused folks in the area. So anything that we can do on our part, as small as it is, distributing masks, we are happy to do. And anything that folks can do to help us is great.
Adama, thank you so much for your time and sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much.
Maybe it's the West Coast wildfires or the cold snap last week, but something has caused hundreds of thousands of birds to die in the Southwest. It's something ornithologist Martha Desmond has been watching. She's a professor at New Mexico State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Ecology. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, and how many dead birds are you finding, and when did this start?
Well, that's a good question, and we don't exactly know the number. We know this is widespread. It's a large number of birds. We would estimate it's at least in the hundreds of thousands. This started in, well, I'll say August 20th, and it started out at White Sands Missile Range, and they started observing a number of dead and lethargic birds and started putting the word out to ornithologists around the state, hey, is anyone else seeing this? And at the time, we thought it was an event that was isolated to the missile range. No one else was seeing that. And then, let's see, September 9th and 10th, there was a large weather event across the western United States. And, when this is migratory season, and birds are migrating south for the winter, and they move in pulses with large weather events. And we saw a large number of birds come south into this region at that time. A lot of birds up north were probably caught off guard. It's unusual, but it does happen where we do see die-offs of birds in the spring or in the fall with weather events. Usually it's a one pulse event such as hail or a snowstorm where you might see hundreds or thousands of birds, occasionally larger numbers. And when this event came through across New Mexico, and we're now hearing parts of Colorado, West Texas, eastern Arizona, there was a large die-off of birds.
And you think that this was weather related and not related to the smoke from the fires in the West?
So some of this is definitely weather related. However, what we don't know, we started seeing this before the weather event happened, so that in itself is troubling, and it brings up the question is what else is contributing to the odd behavior we're seeing in birds and the large number of deaths we're seeing in birds. And so it could be related to the fires. Some birds may have had to change their migratory routes. They may have been forced to leave early. They may have inhaled smoke and have some damage to their lungs.
When you talk about odd behaviors, what does that mean? What are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing birds in lethargic conditions where they're just sitting on the ground and you can walk up to them. We're seeing birds that normally are in shrubs and trees feeding on insects or running around on the ground chasing insects down. We have seen swallows die in groups roosting together in an old nest by a barn swallow, up to a dozen. We've seen birds up in northern New Mexico by the Sulphur Hot Springs die in small groups, some of them even in the hot springs, others kind of grouping into caverns in the ground or outside of a little cavern or burrow in the ground. So just very odd behavior.
Well, and we have had very odd weather. You mentioned some of it there, but certainly it's been an unusual year and it's been an unusual series of years. How much of this is related to climate change, do you think?
It's at this, you know, the scientists in me will say at this point, we really don't know. But certainly here in New Mexico, it's been a very dry year. Most of the deaths that we're seeing are insectivores. And if these birds are having to reroute themselves, and then they're, this is normally not a very active stopover site for birds during the migratory period, and we're seeing some birds that we normally don't see. If they have to, if they're landing here and then there isn't enough food for them to feed on, certainly enough insect, certainly that could cause some of them to starve to death, and that is a drought-related phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that can be done about this by humans?
Yeah, that's a hard question. First, what we need to do right now is kind of get an idea of the magnitude of the issue. So one of the things that we've done is we have a platform on iNaturalists, and it's called the Southwest Avian Mortality Project. And this is where folks can upload pictures that they see or share observations, so that will help us understand the magnitude of this event.
Mm-hmm. When you lose this many birds, that's got to have an effect on the overall population and these species that are being hurt by this.
Absolutely. You know, we have seen an estimated 3 billion birds die since 1970 across the United States. We've seen drastic declines in insects in the United States and North America, and these have had enormous, you know, the declines in insect populations obviously will have an enormous impact on the insectivorous birds. And an event like this, where so many birds have died on populations that are already stressed and species that are already declining, could definitely have an enormous impact.
That is Martha Desmond, a professor at New Mexico State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Ecology. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tanya, as Martha was just saying there, it's not clear what kind of an impact the smoke from the fires has had on those birds. It's possible that that has played a role. But I will say that today, you know, the smoke that you've been dealing with for so long, some of it has even reached the East Coast where I am now. So this has become just a nationwide issue.
Mm-hmm.
Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Protests over police brutality and calls to defund the police have taken a toll on police morale, and now concern that some officers are pulling back from their duties. That's next time on Here and Now.